And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am always happy when I can welcome into our studios Dr. Jeffrey Roberg, professor of political science at Carthage College. He's been there, if I remember correctly, since 1997. And on many occasions over the last, that's more than two decades, isn't it?
Thanks, appreciate that.
Yeah, right. More than a quarter century, actually. Professor Roberg has been a frequent guest to the morning show. It's always been a fun conversation. And we're here because of a course that he is teaching this semester, which comes up every 4 years, coinciding with each presidential election, a course that he taught even before coming to Carthage called Campaigns and Elections. And it is an opportunity for young people, the students in the class, to find out about the nuts and bolts of how political campaigns are waged in the 21st century. And so it's a combination of kind of real life experience coupled with a close examination of what unfolds in that particular year's presidential campaign. So they have been hard at work not only learning in the abstract about how campaigns are done, but have also been following very specifically the way in which Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have waged their campaign over the last weeks and months. So we have a lot to talk about, including the results of Tuesday's election. And so I'm really glad to have not only Professor Roberg with us, but also two of his students, Kayleen Smith, who is actually a history major and political science minor, and Lauren Bukur, who is a political science Mandarin Chinese double major. We welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Professor Roberg, before we start digging into the course, let's have a little debrief on Tuesday night's election. First of all, were you surprised in general at how things went, and not only at the top of the ticket, but in general? Or did this play out in a way that was not especially surprising to you?
So I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. So in terms of the top ticket item of Harris-Trump, going into it, I didn't know which way it was going to go. The polling looked pretty solid. Probably the happiest person out there Wednesday morning was Charles Franklin of the Marquette Law School poll, because he got it right in terms of Wisconsin being so close. And as your listeners know, polling's had some difficulties when it came to trying to identify Trump's voters and what that meant. So like a lot of your listeners, going in, I could have flipped a coin, did not know which way this was going to go. In a broader sense, for Wisconsin, I was a little surprised that Tammy Baldwin had, that it was such a close race. I figured that Trump voters would certainly come out for Trump, but I thought there'd be a little more ticket splitting there. We did see that, certainly so. Trump beat Harris in Wisconsin by just under 30,000 votes, whereas Baldwin looks to have beaten Hovde by less than that. But at the same time, there were 50,000 votes that went to a third-party candidate.
Wow.
They didn't stay Republican for Hovde, and I'm sure there's some soul searching over there about what could have been done differently in terms of those votes. And then more broadly for the country, the Senate was always going to be a hard task for the Democrats. The numbers just didn't line up from the beginning. It didn't matter who was running.
Right.
There were just too many seats to defend. However, in the next set of elections, it'll look better for the Democrats there, because there will be more seats available that they don't have to defend and can be on the offense. And then obviously the House of Representatives, we're still waiting to see. And then the last thing, and this is something we spent quite a bit of time on in our class as well a couple weeks ago, talking about the setup is I guess how I'd phrase it, of that there's going to be fraud and cheating and whatnot that we heard particularly from former President Trump, now President-elect, and J.D. Vance, and Republicans that, you know, if we don't win, it's all fraud. And the data from previous elections doesn't show that we actually have that in the system. And once again, in this election, everything looks, I mean, yes, there were some isolated problems, but once again, the system did what it was supposed to do. And we have to remember that, you know, it's really hard to cheat and do fraud in this country because we're running 50 different elections.
Right.
Right? And so you really have to be masterful at it if you're going to pull that off. And even within Wisconsin, we benefited, 3 weeks ago or so from having the folks from the Wisconsin Elections Commission into class.
Hmm.
They described kind of the system for Wisconsin and how bifurcated or not. Spread out, we'll phrase it that way, it is in Wisconsin as well, and that, you know, there are so many county clerks and whatnot, and again, to try and, you know, do what some have accused that, you know, is happening in our system is just, it's really hard to do.
The notion is really pretty ludicrous that anyone could conceivably do that, and in some ways, it's kind of comical to think about, you know, hurling all these accusations about, you know, a certain party can't do anything right, and yet somehow they're managing to pull off this masterful scheme that is just—it's just impossible for that to be done.
And at the end of the day, Wisconsin did what Wisconsin does, right? So, you know, just under 30,000 votes between Trump and Harris this time. 2020 was decided by about 20,000 votes. 2016 was decided by about 20,000 votes. We're a swing state for a reason.
Right. Now, one of the things that, of course, is generating a great deal of discussion is the fact that, if I remember correctly, Donald Trump won all seven swing states.
There are two still out there where we're kind of still playing with
wondering
a little bit, but it looks that way, yes.
Right. A lot of the discussion that I have read says that what this really comes down to, although it's really hard to say, but that really what this seems to come down to is the matter of the economy and inflation and the fact that life has been really difficult for a whole lot of people, and that difficulty, that high inflation, is associated with incumbent President Joe Biden, and that Kamala Harris had a huge task, in a sense, in shaking off that part of incumbency that was a hindrance. And the fact that this economic difficulty, which has been all over the world in the wake of the COVID pandemic, has really made life difficult for politicians, not just here, I mean incumbent politicians, but all over the world, they are feeling the heat of this. This is a time when voters were very likely going to be wanting to throw off the present and embrace something new, even if it's a former president. But does that make sense to you, or do you think there are other things that mattered even more?
As my students will tell you, I'm not big on single cause explanations. But, I mean, let's start with the economy, and then we can kind of go to some other places. And that, you know, we're of an age that we remember a certain 1992 election with Bill Clinton, and there was a bumper sticker then. It's the economy, stupid.
Mm.
And so certainly inflation and the economy in general did not help Harris. It's hard to run a change campaign, if you will, when your party, when you and obviously President Biden are the ones in office. So she had to carry that burden with her. And there's in a time when it's always easier for the out party to win. So let's start there. Your listeners would have heard President-elect Trump talk about the golden age of America in a variety of forms or whatnot. To me, that's very much a reference to Ronald Reagan's time of mourning in America and the 84 election and whatnot, for older voters to remember a time that is better, right, playing on nostalgia. And it doesn't matter whether the data supports this. He was able to frame the election in these terms that, yes, of course, voters are able to see that, you know, the price of the example that's always given is the price of eggs, right?
Right.
Are higher. Didn't know folks ate so many eggs in this country.
Apparently they do. Apparently they do.
But of course, that's just a, you know, a symptom of larger things when we go to the grocery stores, right? But the framing was such that, you know, the economy is bad, even though people are indeed spending more in terms of their you know, spending money on consumption in general. It's not like they're saving more money and whatnot. They're doing the things that folks who have a general good economic sense do in terms of spending money on some intangibles and whatnot. That's not, I'm not by any way suggesting everyone is in that boat, but the metrics at least, you know, which may not touch a lot of people, are saying, hey, that the economy is decent right now and growing. It's not like we're in recession, right, of previous times. But it's, the framing was done right. And certainly the Trump campaign was very good in terms of framing this election, whether we're talking about economics or we're talking about immigration or, you know, some of these other topics. All of your listeners, of course, have seen a variety of commercials, but there's basically about four topics that they would have seen
right,
over and over and over again. And so each campaign was trying to frame that. And a couple other things I would say is that, you know, despite President-elect Trump's various antics, particularly in the last 3 weeks of this campaign, and, you know, people's unfavorable views of him. And you know, the exit polls, while they're not exact, and there's going to be a lot of ink spilt over the next, you know, few weeks and months and years, what we do know is that, you know, 53%, if we take the exit polls as, you know, at the moment as gospel, we'll throw it on both Trump and Harris, you know, 53% of the voters have an unfavorable view of President-elect Trump.
Right.
By the way, 52% in the same exit polling have an unfavorable view of Harris. Now, maybe that says more about our electoral system than it does the candidates, or maybe it says a lot about the candidates, or again, maybe it says something about the framing of the candidates and how each side framed the other in terms of how we should think about the other candidates. So, you know, when the Trump campaign was on message, then, you know, they framed the problem as really well. Inflation, affording food, affording medicine, you know, immigration issues, you know, all, you know, sometimes you would hear that, you know, we're sending all this money abroad, whether we won't deal with the reality of that today, but you know that, you know,
that's what they're saying,
but yeah, that's out there, right? And that, when on message, that frame is really hard to overcome. The last thing I'll say for now, because we didn't come here to just talk to me,
right,
is that we need to recognize that there were some late deciders in this election too. And that is about 7% of the electorate decided within the last week of this election. 4% apparently decided in the last few days,
wow,
of who they were gonna vote for. And those late deciders of the last week or less broke for President-elect Trump and went that route. And again, part of that is part of that is good campaigning in terms of whether it be the ads or it be peer pressure in terms of friends, right? Well, friends talk to friends, right? Part of that could be of their own personal needs, right? There's a lot of potential factors that go into it.
Right. Two quick things I want to just follow up on. One of them is the fact that Kamala Harris was the presidential candidate, if I remember correctly, for 110 days.
107.
107. Yeah. Okay, not even 110. Right. So I think some analysts have really pointed to that as more of an issue than maybe a lot of people realized in the thick of it, that her public profile, the way in which the general public knew about her compared to Donald Trump, was was vastly different, and she had lots of ground to make up in terms of connecting with, even as vice president. Just that's not actually all that high profile a position, and so she had a lot of ground to make up and not a lot of time to do it. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's a very fair assessment, and I would go further than that. So first of all, she benefited in one way because, of course, President Biden had a whole campaign set up already. And so she benefited from having those people already doing certain things. Where she didn't benefit was she didn't get to, on the ground floor, kind of decide, hey, this is what I want to do, right? And when you're the in candidate, right, when you're the in party candidate, you have to live with whatever things were there before. George H.W. Bush found this, right, with Reagan back in the day, and he was fortunate to have a good economy at that time and was right. able to become. But there's a reason we don't get vice presidents very often that become presidents,
mm-hmm.
because there's honestly not a lot that a president can do regarding an economy to make it better or worse. But they like to take the credit, and when you take the credit, you also get the blame. So 107 days is really rough to be. So a normal process would have had a couple of months where Harris introduced herself to the country and said, this is my bio, this is who I am, these are the values I believe in. We compress that all into about 2 weeks, right?
Right.
And so if you're asking voters, who is she? There's a lot of, there's a lot of room for the other side to define her in negative ways. And we certainly saw that early on and throughout this 107-day campaign. And B, there's not as much time for her to be able to define herself out there as well and say, this is what I've done, this is who I am, this is why I can be a good president for you. So that's a tough ask first. Now let's take that and put the 107 days aside, and then you've got the issue of how did she wind up being on the ticket, right? Mm-hmm. And, with everything that went into that in terms of, I'll let your listeners decide whether Biden was pushed or jumped, right?
Right, right.
Take your pick. But there was no formal Democratic primary, right? And there's a reason we have primaries in our election system, is to get to know different candidates and kind of test them out and kick the tires, if you will, and see whether we like their policies, and they get a chance to refine their policies. And so as far as Harris's policies, right, those are all on the fly of, okay, what are we going to do here? And then you also don't get the time to make the gaffes when it's low pressure. Instead, you make the gaffes when it's high pressure. Mm. So, one of her biggest that your listeners saw replayed often was when she went on The View and was asked, what would you do different, right?
Nothing comes to mind.
Right. And that one would think that would be an answer you'd have ready. But, you would if you had a longer campaign to try
Absolutely.
And figure that out.
Right.
So there's issues there. And I think part of not having the primary process run as usual meant that Harris couldn't be quite as prepared as she otherwise might have been. And, of course, you have some disaffected voters within the Democratic Party, as well as, of course, on the Republican side as well, saying, well, the process was not what we understand the process to be. So what does that mean? And so right now, if we look at voting in this country for this election, understanding, of course, there's still some votes being counted, this election was about 15 million votes less than 2020.
Wow.
Okay. And so that's, for an election that was being phrased as this is the most consequential election of our lives, right? 15 million extra folks sat home. And we always have people sit home, don't get me wrong.
Right.
By the way, your listeners know that Wisconsin actually is not a state that does that. We actually vote very, very well here. So your listeners should be very proud of that fact.
Right. Very good. One last quick question, then we'll bring in our two students. One thing that is intriguing about President Trump's victory is that, and I've heard it called this by a couple of different people, perhaps the most diverse coalition in Republican Party history. That is, when you total up all of the people who went for Donald Trump, it was, I mean, I think that it is easy from the other side to think of them as, in very sort of monolithic, simplistic terms, who voted for Donald Trump. And the fact is that actually they come from vastly different constituencies, and that in some respects this was not so much an embrace of Trumpism, if you want to call it that, as a rejection of the current president and what he has done or not done about the economy. Do you think that's a fair assessment, or is that a bit simplistic?
I think it's fair, and I wouldn't say it's simplistic. I just think I would say it's not complete.
Mm.
And so, yes, what we see certainly is that Trump was able to tap larger into some populations that he already had gotten before. And I think the economic side of this plays a role. You were running stories on the national NPR this morning about women and about Latinos, right?
Mm.
And all of that is, you know, I have no argument with any of that. Your listeners also heard a story about college versus non-college, mm. right? And whether they're talking about women or men and the gender gap in general. So there's, I think what we're going to see is, like what the Republicans did in following the 2012 election, we'll see an autopsy for the Democrats. What that'll look like, I'm not quite sure. But my immediate take on this is that Democrats need to think about who it is that we represent. The old coalition of Democratic Party is not quite what it is now. So we saw this play out, for instance, with unions, right?
Mm.
And while there's certainly seems to be a disconnect between union leadership and the Teamsters versus their members, what we know is that certainly union members in general, not just only the Teamsters, but other unions here, are split, right?
Mm.
Whereas there was a time in this country, not all that long ago, where if you were a union member, you were kind of pretty much guaranteed to be in the Democratic, you know, side of things, right? The Democrats need to decide and think about who did we miss when we were in this election in terms of they've kind of written off a good portion of the map, saying, mm. it's going to go red, we're just going to ignore that. And if you ignore those areas, then they're definitely going, you know, to the Republicans.
Darker and darker red, right? In a sense.
And
I mean,
so,
more decisively.
You know, there is a good portion of the population that's rural in the United States. Democrats need to think about how to talk to rural voters or lower level economic voters, and for that matter, non-college and voters, and particularly the one group that definitely needs to be figured out by both parties, honestly, is the Latino Hispanic, which is not one monolithic group, and they've heard me say this dozens of times, but you know, Cubans and Mexicans and Venezuelans and El Salvadorians and Nicaraguans and, you know, Argentines and whatnot, they have different interests.
Hmm.
They're not all just, you know, you can't just group them together. And so the Democratic Party and the Republican Party need to figure out how to address concerns better of all these groups, obviously, as in a general sense, but more specifically too, because at the end of the day, that's our largest voting group. You've got about 800,000 people in this voting group of broadly speaking Hispanics and Latinos that are coming of age to vote each year.
Wow.
Okay. And so if you don't figure that out, then you cannot possibly tap the potential power of that group.
Hmm. We're speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Jeffrey Roberg, a professor of political science at Carthage, and he has with him two students that we are eager to hear from now. Kayleen Smith, a history and history major, political science minor, and Lauren Bukur, who is a political science and Mandarin Chinese major, both students in Professor Roberg's campaigns and elections course. So first of all, I want to hear from each of you, what drew you to want to be part of this particular course? What specific interest and or aspirations after Carthage, for what reason did this course make sense for you to take? And this is Lauren.
Yeah, well, for me, it was kind of funny because I am a political science major, but a lot of my interests lie in comparative politics, international relations, not really the domestic sphere. So for me, I had no general base knowledge of how does domestic politics function. And Roberg is my advisor for faculty, and he's taught intro to international relations, and so I knew his class would be great. And so when I saw it listed, I just decided, you know, I have to fill this kind of gap that I have in my knowledge about domestic issues before I can even think to address any international issues. So that's why I decided to take the class.
Fascinating. How about you, Kayleen?
So for me, with my political science minor, most of those classes have been taught by Dr. Roberg. And I'm kind of the opposite of Lauren. My political interests lie in our domestic sphere. But it was interesting to see the opportunity to kind of get into the nuts and bolts and the nitty-gritty of American campaigns and see how they work and how they flow and what it takes to start them. And I figured if anyone was going to teach me how to do it, I would listen to Dr. Roberg the most. So
so there we are, and here we are. Very good. So I would be really curious to hear about what was, in terms of learning about how campaigns are waged, what was perhaps most illuminating and or surprising? I mean, in terms of things about campaigns that had never even occurred to you that would be significant or that would work in the way that they do. Can you think of anything that stands out in that respect? This is Lauren.
Yeah, well, my role in the campaigns and elections class, we are running a fake campaign and putting our teacher, Dr. Roberg, against Brian Steil in a fictional campaign. And my role is fundraising / coffee. And I originally thought I had no idea what that meant. And apparently during campaigns, they have cocktail parties and coffee parties to find funds from a pool of donors just in the area. And I honestly didn't know where the money comes from, but it definitely illuminated kind of sort of the process behind getting the fundraising going.
And that whole social aspect of it.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
How about you, Kayleen?
I think it was because I've had some experience working for some like state and local campaigns, but it was interesting to get like the nuts and bolts and the more thorough view of how these national campaigns work and how congressional campaigns work, because those are the commercials that run most frequently are those wider district elections. But you don't necessarily know like the ins and outs of that. So to be able to really kind of get into the deep end and into the thick of how it all goes, and then tying that into, like Lauren was saying, our campaigns project as a semi-real life application of all of it is really cool.
Yeah, love that. So is that always the way you've done this, with talking about the real world and then this kind of fake campaign as kind of a extension of that?
Since I've been at Carthage, yes. When I ran the course originally, pre-Carthage, no. But it seems to work quite well in terms of, you know, there's only so much book knowledge, right, that you can do. You gotta make sure folks have a sense of what this looks like in reality. So we're, you know, I can teach them, hey, this is how do we come up with our magic number for number of votes that we need for the district. But when they have to actually go and hunt that down, because I don't just provide it to them, I just say, okay, now go take a look what's happened in the last decade of elections in our district, and what do we need and what do we need to understand, and how, for instance, as your older listeners know, that Our district has changed a lot. As thank you, by the way, for saying I've been here over a quarter century.
can't argue with the math. The math doesn't lie.
But you know, this district has changed a lot in that time, and so you know, we need to take that into account, and the students get to experience that.
Right. So I'm curious to hear from the students as they have followed the campaigns of Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Kamala Harris. What were some moments in this campaign that struck you as especially noteworthy or perhaps surprising in terms of I wonder why they're doing that, or I wonder why this has created the effect that it has? I would just be curious again about that aspect of this course in which you are closely following the way this campaign is waged, more closely than probably a lot of the rest of us have.
Kayleen? I would say the first thing that comes to mind predates the semester even starting was the transition from President Biden to Vice President Harris and how that happened. But I think that even though that was, you know, over the summer, that still, we've seen that effect up until Tuesday evening of, do we think that was the right call, or do we think that, you know, pushed Vice President Harris forward, or that was a step in favor to boost now President-elect Trump? Like, that had plenty of ripple effects that could still be seen even as our semester got started. So I would definitely say for me that that was one of the biggest things, because that was still in play. As an underlying theme kind of the entire time.
Absolutely. Lauren?
Yeah, for me, one of the most surprising things was how fast the media cycle was going through the stories in this election. You know, we had not one but two assassination attempts against former president, now president-elect, Donald Trump. And it seemed as those stories were maybe in the news for 1, 2, 3 days, and then they were quickly moved on from. And then another thing that really surprised me was the failure of the Harris campaign to critique the current administration, Biden's administration, especially with what you said on The View. She said nothing comes to mind in changing. And I think that really dissipated some of the enthusiasm that a lot of the young voters had initially had when they switched to her as the new candidate.
Interesting. I certainly remember that moment well, and I think Kamala Harris would be the first to say that she muffed that answer. She actually said that in so many words.
Right.
I think she very much regrets that she was kind of caught by surprise by that question. And it really kind of underscores the delicate situation that a vice president finds themselves in, where you don't want to trash talk your own president. And yet there were very real reasons for her to try to distance herself. And how does she do that? But I'm curious to hear more about what you mean by young voters, that you think for you and other fellow young voters, that was very much a turnoff, maybe even more than it would have been for like a voter like me.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I've spoken with a lot of voters on campus. I was in, as a member of the executive board of Carthage Dems and also Pi Sigma Alpha and also student government, I ran in the election role at Carthage campus with the director of Office of Student Life. And I got to talk to a lot of different students at Carthage. And I know a lot of them were pretty disaffected from voting for Harris, specifically on Israel-Gaza, the issue, and the failure to kind of put in a new policy. But just introducing new policies and changing the current administration's way of doing things, it sort of felt like Harris was just a Biden part two electric boogaloo, so to speak.
Right. And well, and certainly not across the board, but for a certain kind of voter, and particularly lots of young voters really hoping for something very new and very fresh, suddenly Kamala Harris did not seem to be as new and fresh a possibility.
For sure. I think that's the main critique. Yeah.
Interesting.
And I would say also when it was still Biden versus Trump, I feel like there was a lot of, this is two old white guys. And no matter which one you pick, is an old white guy really going to represent and be in touch with, you know, the up-and-coming voters who are casting presidential votes for the first time? So there was a chance there for Vice President Harris to kind of grab hold of that and potentially have a stronghold in that base. And then kind of like Lauren was saying, it was more of like a Biden part two and her, you know, not being willing to say these are things I would like to do different. Kind of gave a little bit of pause that, oh, maybe it's not going to be quite as different. I mean, she's not an old white guy, but, you know, there's still more policy-wise and priority-wise that didn't seem all that different.
Interesting.
This gets us back to your point about the 107 days, mm-hmm. right? That if you don't get a chance to develop those ideas, then you're not going to have them.
Right. Well, and if you have a misstep like that, there's less opportunity, less time to, in a sense, make up lost ground. I'm just curious, and maybe this is a little too personal a question, but so just ignore it if you choose. But I mean, I didn't particularly want to ask either of you, are you more red or blue, or are you Democrat, Republican, or conservative, liberal, whatever. But I am curious what it meant to you to have a presidential candidate who was a woman. And how personally invested did that matter to you? Because I think that's kind of an intriguing question. And, of course, there's the very real possibility that there are all kinds of Americans who are not prepared to vote for a woman for president, no matter who they are or what they stand for, and others who are desperate to have that first woman president. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious from each of you, if you're comfortable answering, mm-hmm. How much did that figure in your own feelings about this particular race?
So for me, I do lean left politically. I was, you know, planning to vote for President Biden when it was still him, but it was kind of like a, okay, like coming back to the old white guy thing, two old white guys, got to vote for one of them. And so then when it became that it was going to be Vice President Harris, it was like, oh, okay, you know, I'm going to have the chance to vote for a woman now, because I was 13 when Secretary Clinton was trying to become the next president. So I was excited that, you know, there could be a woman, but at 13, I didn't have, like, the voting power to do anything about that.
Right.
So it was exciting to kind of have that part of little me to be able to be like, oh, like, I get to do what we didn't get to do 8 years ago. Mm. But then, you know, there's still kind of that apprehensiveness, like we've talked about, of how much different is she going to be than President Biden? You know, am I voting for a lot of the same policies? I think I can confidently say for both Lauren and I, we try to be pretty educated voters. So just being able to kind of confidently cast that vote that, you know, things might be different than they are now.
Right. Interesting. How about you, Lauren, if you want to answer?
Sure. Well, I've taken a course called Women in Politics with another Carthage professor, Dr. Hauser, and we talked about just internationally, the role of women in politics, mm-hmm. and also policies that impact women. And so I was definitely encouraged to see a woman running for president, especially after Hillary Clinton's failed campaign in 2016, just because the USA actually lags behind a lot of different countries in just representation of women in our Congress. And so that's just one part of it. Obviously, I wouldn't vote for her just because she's a woman, mm-hmm. but she also has the abortion issue. But as we looked at in the exit polls, that wasn't enough to even sway older white women or the suburban white woman to join her cause. And so I think as a woman, she definitely had that the abortion on her side, especially for Kayleen and I's group, you know, younger, college-educated white women. But other than that, I don't think she really convinced a lot of other women in the electorate to vote for her.
Interesting. In preparation for this, one of the things I did was listen to the most recent episode of Pod Save America, which is quite an interesting podcast. And for those who aren't acquainted with it, its co-hosts all worked in the Obama administration and his campaign, mm-hmm. as speechwriters and so on, and advisors. And in their recap of Tuesday night's election results, one of the points that they made is that, and I think Professor Roberg kind of touched on this, is the fact that at the moment, the Democratic Party does not seem to be very successful in reaching less engaged voters. I mean, voters who are not listening to politically themed podcasts, or certainly if they are, they're listening to a very narrow range and seem to have no particular interest in politics aside from kind of the most sort of surface level. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, not all of us have to be equally interested in the same things, but there are many people like that. And particularly in this time of disaffection, where a lot of people are just kind of frustrated with the political system and finding themselves sort of drawn away from it, what would be your advice as two young people in terms of how less engaged voters can be reached and can be persuaded? I mean, in the taking of this course, has anything come to mind that might be viable possibilities?
Well, I think on a larger scale, a lot of less engaged voters are so because policy doesn't seem like it's being passed. We have a polarized Congress. It's either, you know, the Dems have the presidency and then they don't have the House or they don't have the Senate. And so they face just backlash on all fronts. And I saw an interesting video as I was, you know, scrolling on the social media feed just after the election. And someone said, if the Republicans take both the presidency, the Senate, and the House, well, then there's no excuse for nothing to be done. And so it maybe would engage more people that policy would be able to be passed, whether it's conservative policy or bipartisan support.
Right, whether it's policy you like or don't like.
Exactly, but it could definitely show that our system isn't dysfunctional and that we're actually able to pass new law.
And that would excite some people.
Definitely.
In way or another, either for you or against.
Get more people into politics if they're against it, right?
Absolutely.
Right. Because their vote has an actual, you know, say.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think expanding off of that, you know, if you're a left-leaning voter and you're looking at all of the things that, you know, assuming that the House falls into Republican control, that, you know, the Republican, you know, all aspects of government working in tandem and they're passing things and you're like, I don't like this. Well, then suddenly it's, what can I do about it? And the simple answer is to vote. And so I think that that's something that kind of Lauren was saying would definitely make less engaged voters more aware. Is, you know, if they've decided that policies that are passed down don't work for them, the only way to change that on a surface level is to vote. Because one thing that came to mind for me was with no excuse to get nothing done was when President Obama had the House and the Senate and most notably passed the Affordable Care Act. You know, that was something that certainly got done. So seeing similar aspects to that, I think like major legislation potentially, for better or for worse, would kind of wake up the voters who are kind of seeing everything like from a distance.
Interesting. So one of the things Professor Roberg,
thank you very much.
That's quite a promotion. Yeah,
appreciate it.
I consider him more a dictator in class.
Okay. Fair enough. We won't go there. We don't have enough time. Professor Roberg said before we went on the air something to the effect that by studying the nuts and bolts of how campaigns are run, how campaigns are waged, you could, as students in the class, be equipped to some extent to be part of political campaigns, I mean, in a really significant way down the road. I'm just curious if either of you have aspirations about that and or also aspirations of maybe even entering this arena as someone who might hold office someday. I'm just curious if either of you have feelings about that and if this current election has affected that or tempered that in any way.
Well, I guess I can start because Kayleen's looking at me. Yeah, I didn't really have any aspirations to go into any form of office before taking this class, and now I still really don't. You know, I'm not sure how things will look like for me in the future. I definitely would want to be a part of government, but probably not into an elected office. But I did get to do some hands-on get-out-the-vote voter mobilization and kind of get on the ground and what a campaign looks like. Mm-hmm. So that was very interesting. And I'm not opposed to it, per se, but it's definitely not my top choice.
Hmm. How about you, Kayleen?
So as I mentioned, I have a little bit of experience working for a state Senate campaign in Illinois where I live. And then I've also had a couple of internships on the official side of things in a state representative's office. And then this summer I added a congressional office to that as well. Sometimes people will tell me, oh, like, I can see you in office one day. Like, I can see that happening. And my thing is always that, like, I don't necessarily know if, like, I'll be the representative, like, if I'll be the official. But I like being able to do that kind of work that, like, talks with the constituents. And this is how I can help them. And, you know, over the summer with the congressional office, it was giving me the chance to, you know, see how congressional offices can be liaisons with federal agencies. And it's a similar thing at the state level as well. So I don't necessarily know, like, if I would be the elected official, but I like doing the work with elected officials that I believe in and help and being a part of that.
Fantastic. Well, we would cheer you on for that, for sure. Absolutely.
Thank you.
That's great. That's great. Great to hear. Music to the ears of Professor Rolberg, I'm sure. And I think you made two very good selections in these particular students joining you today. Would you agree?
I would indeed.
Well, thank you.
No surprise. Thanks. So Professor Jeff Rolberg, professor of political science at Carthage College, and two of his students in his campaigns and elections course, Kayleen Smith from Moline, Illinois, a history major and political science minor, and Lauren Bukur from Berwyn, Illinois, a political science and Mandarin Chinese double major. Thank you so much to all three of you for being here on the morning show for what I think has been a really interesting conversation, and best wishes to all of you.
Thank you for having us.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm going to be speaking with a very prolific author by the name of Gary Parker about his most recent book called The Playbook. And it is all about football and high school football, and a wonderful novel in which a woman is serving as a football coach, and two quarterbacks on the team develop an unlikely friendship. One of them, the established starter who is suddenly felled by a serious illness, and the other, a talented but scrappy and maybe flaky young man from a very dysfunctional family who suddenly finds himself thrust into the limelight and the starting role. It's a wonderfully written novel. And from the archives then, a conversation with Jeff Pearl about his book, Ball for a Buck, which tells the intriguing story of the USFL. Its rapid rise and its equally rapid demise. That's tomorrow on the morning show here on WGTD. Today is going to be a sunny day and seasonal with a high of 59 degrees, clear skies overnight, and cold overnight low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow, much like today, sunny with a high of 58 degrees. A few clouds rolling in on Saturday, still 58 for a high. Right now, it looks like we have a 60% chance of rain on Sunday. Daytime high still right around 60 degrees. Right now it looks like a lovely Veterans Day on Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.